of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Thursday, March 5th. We do not yet have a quorum. We're going to move some items around on the agenda and have Representative Kelly go first because he's the only one in the room. So, Representative Kelly, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Representative Tim Kelly, and help me out here. Should I move the amendment first or actually move the House file first?
Representative Kelly, we don't yet have a quorum, so we really can't, you know, move and vote on things. So why don't you just talk about your bill and then talk about the amendment, and then we'll move it as soon as we get a quorum.
Great. Thank you. Madam Chair, this House file really, we've been hearing lately in public safety and public safety finance a lot about efficiencies, and I think this department bill speaks directly to efficiencies. So I have with us Terry Gerlicher from the Department of Corrections, who will help us with the explanation of what this bill is.
Go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Terry Gerlicher, G-E-R-L-I-C-H-E-R. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, Office of Special Investigations. The segment of that division for the agency is responsible for the Fugitive Apprehension Unit. There are seven of us that are sworn peace officers within the Department of Corrections, and our responsibility under that hat is to take back into custody those parties that are committed to the Commissioner of Corrections who are out in the street or who have escaped from an institution. Currently, if an adult either violates their release status or escapes from an institution or walks away from an institution, a felony warrant is issued for their arrest. If a juvenile who's been adjudicated delinquent and is committed to the Commissioner of Corrections either violates a furlough release status or escapes from the secure custody of a facility at Red Wing, the warrant that is issued for their arrest is a gross misdemeanor. And with a gross misdemeanor arrest, law enforcement officers are not allowed to make forcible entry into the home after having articulable suspicion that they're there to take that juvenile back into custody. And what this bill does is allows law enforcement the exception of making forcible entry into homes to take these gross misdemeanor warranted juveniles back into custody and bringing them back to the Department of Corrections.
Questions from members? All right. Seeing none, do you want to talk about the amendment a little bit, Representative Kelly, just so members know what the amendment is and does?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The amendment here is really defining who we're talking about in the rest of the juvenile, and also that they're committed to the custody of the Commissioner of Correction. There was an issue with the counties had some questions, and again, I'll rely on this. Gerlicher to explain that.
Okay, Representative Kelly, we now officially have a quorum, so I'll formally call this meeting to order. And Representative Kelly moved the H01021. Oh, we have to first move the bill, sorry. Representative Kelly moved that House File 1021 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Representative Kelly moved the H1021A1 amendment. And did you have anything to add, Ms. Gerlicher?
Madam Chair, committee members, the amendment narrows the population of juveniles to only those who have been committed to the Commissioner of Corrections.
Thank you. And members, technically, I don't think any of the amendments that we have today met the 24-hour rule. So without objection from the committee, we will be, you know, considering these amendments as we go. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 1021? Please come to the table. All right, seeing none, Representative Kelly renews his motion, and the chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you.
Is Representative Lesch here? Representative Lesch is not yet here, so could I get someone to move the minutes? Representative Bingham moves the minutes for March 3rd. Any changes or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, members. I see that Representative Palin is in the room. Representative Palin, even though Representative Lesch is not yet here to report on his committee, we're going to have you get started. So if you please come to the table. Members, Representative Palin's bill was heard in Representative Lesch's committee, and it did pass out of that committee. So when Representative Lesch gets here, we'll have him give a brief committee report. But if you'd go ahead, Representative Palin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 551 is known as the Safe Neighborhoods Act, and is the result of a response to repeat sex offender living, moving into and living in the Chautauqua City area, who continues to reoffend with non-contact offenses in Minnesota. But the effect on the community has been fairly severe, and working with Chief Kevin Stenson from the Lakes Area Police Department, with Bill Denae from the Department of Corrections, with Harry Kennedy from the Governor's Office and Department of Public Safety, as well as engaged community members, one of whom is here today, we've really realized that these non-contact offenses, the stalking, the indecent exposure, have the same effect when they're repeated over and over as actual contact sex offense. And so the proposal in what should be Section 2 in the amended engrossment establishes a felony after the third offense of the list that you should see in Section 2. Section 3 is changed from the bill. Originally required mandatory predatory offender training, working with the Department of Human Services, Department of Corrections, and Department of Public Safety, and taking their input. I am satisfied that the appropriate step this year will be to tweak the training that currently exists. It's very powerful, and make sure that it's appropriate training for child care providers, for nursing home workers, for folks who work with vulnerable adults. I think 15 minutes of prevention is worth a lifetime of making sure that we're protecting the most vulnerable in our society. So with that, Madam Chair, Chief Stenson is with me, and as well as Ann Tripper, the owner of a daycare center down the street from where Mr. Holmgren lives.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Kevin Stenson, and I'm with the Lakes Area Police Department in Lindstrom and Chautauqua City.
Please go ahead.
In 2005, the city of Chautauqua had a person by the name of Jeffrey Holmgren move in to the community right next to a daycare and a block away from an elementary school. The police department was notified that Jeffrey Holmgren was moving in as he was a registered offender from another state, from Nebraska. Being that he was convicted in another state, he was not assigned a risk level. That alone hampers law enforcement on how we can regard a particular offender. Soon after Mr. Holmgren had moved in to the area, he continued to reoffend, but he continued to offend at a level just below what would trigger a total redoing or looking at his offense level. These are indecent exposure or disorderly conduct type offenses, but he does continue to reoffend. Currently, Mr. Holmgren is incarcerated for a stalking offense in a neighboring community on a juvenile female. And while he was awaiting trial on that, offended once more in St. Paul. I believe what the bill is attempting to do is clarify the risk level of somebody moving into Minnesota from an outside state conviction and assigning them a risk level according to the state of Minnesota guidelines. This particular person and this particular circumstance has created much fear in our communities. And bumping up the offense level for non-contact offenses would greatly enhance law enforcement's ability to handle sex offenders from, especially from other states moving in, having those non-contact but continual offenses and causing great fear in our communities.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, it sounds like, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Kevin Stenson with
Thank you. Officer Stenson. This would be, so anytime there was somebody that committed now two or more sex offenses, you're talking about exposure even, aren't you, or not?
Correct.
It sounded like you were.
Well,
Mr. Stenson.
It'd be the third offense, I believe, and it'd be a non-contact offense such as indecent exposure.
Indecent exposure. So,
Representative Mullering.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just thinking of when I had a bill in that would treat, and I floated it just to see what would happen. I think it was eight offenses for what could be charged as indecent exposure. Urinating in public could be charged as indecent exposure. So, and that was, I kind of, most people here laughed at the idea of creating a felony for that. And yet, this would be three. Urinating in public would qualify for this. So, a lot of our homeless in downtown Minneapolis would suddenly be guilty of a felony under this bill. Madam Chair, I think people have to think about where this is going.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mullery. I appreciate you raising the concern. I think prosecutorial discretion is a key element here. Thanks to Mr. Dene, Bill Dene from the Department of Corrections, we did on the disorderly conduct clarify in division in the amendment that disrupting meetings three times was not an example of an offense that could be charged under the proposed crime I'm sorry, I had the sections backwards, but now in section 3, and so you'll see that on line 2.12 and 2.13, we did clarify the disorderly conduct, that it'll be clause 3. I think the key here is prosecutorial discretion. It's a tool in a toolbox that doesn't exist today, and I would certainly hope that that no prosecutor would just satisfy that urination on its own would classify. But the reality is there is a gap that needs to be closed here, a loophole that needs to be closed, and that's what this section will do.
Representative Mullery, we're not voting on this bill today.
Okay.
We're going to lay it over, and so if you have, we do have to send it to health, I guess. We do have to send it to health, but if you have some concerns, if we certainly could, Representative Kalin has been working with a number of members, and I'm certain he will continue to work with you to make sure that we address those.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Mullery.
I've been on this committee for quite a while, and a majority of my years here, and I get that on every bill. Well, there's a huge loophole here, and we can rely on prosecutors never to charge those kind of offenses that don't make any sense under them, and then usually within about 4 to 6 months, some prosecutor does it, and then it starts going further. So I don't always rely on what may be the good intentions of the bill author to stop prosecutors.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kalin, what is the what other stops has this been to? It's just this one and Representative Lester's committee?
Representative Kalin.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, so far the Crime Victims Division of this policy committee, because of the training implications for daycare providers and others, we're going to healthcare with the support of this committee. We'll be going to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, Representative Thiessen's committee, and then I believe we will have to go to Representative Paymar's Public Safety Finance Committee, and I believe that Representative Mullery, you're not on that committee, but I will continue working with you as the chair mentioned.
And Representative Mullery, there is, of course, as you know, the more folks that are in the net, the larger the fiscal note gets, and so we'll be looking at the fiscal expenses as well. So, Representative Anderson, did you have a question? Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this? Oh, you please come to the table. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Ann Tripler, and I'm a daycare provider in Chisago City, Minnesota.
All right, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Tripler, and I live in Chisago City, Minnesota. I'm here speaking to you today on a very important issue, the Safe Neighborhoods Act. I've been dealing with many of these issues before you today for the last 4 years. A level 3 sex offender's behavior has affected my family business, my neighborhood, and my family's overall quality of life. In 2005, a sex offender moved into our neighborhood where I run a licensed family daycare. We learned that this sex offender moved into the area from Nebraska where he committed a sex felony against a minor. He did not have a sexual offender level assigned to him through the Minnesota Department of Corrections upon moving here, which angered and frustrated neighbors and residents. Despite this, however, we as residents and concerned parents maneuvered our way through the local and state government channels to see that a specific loophole in our sexual offender guideline was addressed, and this sex offender was reevaluated and given a level 3 classification. Along the way, this individual also reoffended by soliciting a prostitute, harassing a teenager in St. Paul, and harassing several preteens in the North Branch area. His actions are becoming more and more disturbing. We need to keep those who pose a threat of reoffense off our streets. Because of the sex offender's criminal past, 2 families with 4 children left my daycare in fear of this individual. My home is situated at a dead-end city street, and the school-aged children must pass in front of the sex offender's house to access the elementary school less than a block away. Because of this fact, I was forced to cut my daycare rates so parents could pay for an all-day alternative kindergarten program so that their children would not be walking to and from school alone. The resulting economic loss and emotional trauma nearly made me close my daycare after 15 years of operation in both Chisago and Hennepin County. The testimony that you are hearing today is helping our efforts to the Minnesota State Legislature to move forward. We are here before you today praying you will see fit to change the guidelines so that no one else will be able to reoffend and affect the emotional or physical development of our youth. I am not here making this a personal issue between myself or the sex offender that lives next door to me. This is there is a bigger picture that I'm striving for. No parent, daycare provider, should have to worry if their children, while walking to school, playing in a playground, or just being the kid on a bike, are safe in their own neighborhoods. I acknowledge that people like this particular sex offender may need to have professional help. What has concerned me and concerns others is the unlawful and antisocial behavior that seems to escalate in severity if nothing is done. We are concerned that at some time a child may be physically or emotionally injured due to the sex offender or sex offender's actions. This is a universal public safety concern for all devoted parents and conscientious citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table and state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, fellow members, my name is Dave Jansen, and I live in the city of Minneapolis. And after the lady who just testified, I can't remember your name, I'm sorry, and I am a firm believer that if we, on the first-time offender, sexual offender, have treatment of some sort with punitive damages, with punitive over his or her head, punitive could be a hefty fine or community service. That would teach that individual that crime does not pay. And to me, getting them early, getting the help they need will hopefully get them the treatment, the help, and everything they need. That's all I have, ma'am.
Thank you. Is there questions from members? Seeing none, Representative West, now that you're here, we actually should move the adoption of your report so we can move this bill.
So
move that, sir. So Representative West would move the adoption of the division report on House File. Should we take 561 first, or should we take them all together, Representative West?
No, we take them all together.
Okay, Representative West moves the division report on House File 248, 551, 720, and 818, and the committee made the recommendation that all of these should pass, Representative West?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Questions from members for Representative West? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Now, Representative West, do you want to move Representative Kalin's bill? The motion is to move it to the Health Care and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee.
I will so move that.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kalin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Hamer is not yet in the room, so I guess I will present my two bills. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to move House File 70? Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 720, the Chief of Civil Law. Yep, to be
referred
to Civil
Law.
To move House File 720, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. Great. To your bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to actually turn this over to my testifiers. This was brought to me by the Uniform Law Commission. And in your packet, it does have the information about the bill. And just so you know, that this was adopted, completed by the Uniform Laws Commission in 2002. It was approved by the American Bar Association, and it has been adopted in Idaho, Nevada, and Oklahoma.
Sounds good. Testifier, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Harriet Lansing. I am a Uniform Law Commissioner from the state of Minnesota, and I'm also a judge on the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee and to the bill.
Thank you. I'm here this afternoon in my capacity as a Uniform Law Commissioner. This bill is, the purpose of this bill is to provide an effective method of protecting children from the emotional and psychological trauma often associated with giving testimony while continuing to protect the Sixth Amendment confrontation rights of defendants and respondents. Essentially, it has three goals. It extends the current provisions for child witness testimony by alternative means, which apply only to violent criminal offenses. It would extend it to nonviolent crimes, to civil litigation, and to administrative litigation. It provides a structure and a procedure for obtaining this testimony, which makes it, we believe, easier to apply for judges and in court proceedings, and also for litigants, and particularly for children who are often disabled in their capacity to present testimony, and also for a long time after providing this testimony have suffered from the effects of what for them is a traumatic courtroom situation. And third, it aids courts in obtaining the testimony and maintaining the integrity of the evidentiary process. It has worked very well in terms of this structure that we've developed for the violent crimes, and so what we're trying to do is to extend that to the nonviolent crimes, to civil and to administrative. The act is pretty straightforward, and you have an excellent overview in the summary. I can say more about it if you would like to hear. The Uniform Act was initially considered for promulgation as a court rule, but because of the existence of MnSTAT Section 595.02, it was determined that the better course was to amend the current law rather than to promulgate a court rule that might have some inconsistencies. I'm happy to answer any questions.
That's it, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have a couple questions from members. Representative Anderson, you're first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilsum, while you're a testifier, you mentioned that this has been passed in other states, and I'm just wondering how long has this bill been in effect, and which was the first state to pass it, and to what effect has it been as far as been utilized by the state, and to what benefit, what were the results of those states utilizing this law?
Judge Lansing?
And I don't you have the year, so I'm going to rely on you for that.
Well, it passed the Uniform Law Commission in 2002, but I don't have the individual timeline for each state. This is just a packet that the Uniform Laws Commission sent, and so I don't have that information, but I can get it for you.
Representative Anderson. Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, the way our process works is after it is passed by the Uniform Law Commission, then it's available for the states for enactment. And we have in throughout the other states some vestige of this provision, but these are the states that have adopted the full range of the act. I have talked with our central office, and to their knowledge, there has been reported no negative results of this, and we do try to keep a tally on anything that comes up, and occasionally if there's a problem in a state that demonstrates that we need to look at a particular provision, we then bring it back on the floor of the Uniform Law Commission and revise it. This has not been subject to revision because we have not had any negative effects. Because this is a time which people are looking at confrontation rights and other issues, this one has been very carefully looked at to make sure that these are primarily procedural issues and that we're not changing the substantive state law.
Follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. What promulgated this incident here in the state of Minnesota to bring, from your standpoint, to bring it forward, or is it just based on what other states have done that you've brought this forward? Is it, there must be some incident that would have you could cite, I would guess.
Lansing?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. The primary motivation for it in Minnesota was Judge Catherine Anderson, who was a district court judge in Hennepin County. And she was working with children who were testifying on a regular basis before the court. She was very concerned that the testimony that was being provided by children was being compromised because there wasn't a procedure in place to take into account the effect that these testimonial circumstances was having on the children. That no one was really looking at it from the child's standpoint of being in the courtroom and being frightened of saying things, also being the integrity of the testimony as well in terms of being distracted by the jury immediately around them, by sort of being under focus for cross-examination, these kinds of things all happening simultaneously. And so she was very interested in trying to help develop a method where all of these things that were happening simultaneously could be taken into account, and procedures could be developed through the interaction of the attorneys and the judge to make better provisions for obtaining the evidence and trying to maintain the integrity of it. Judge Anderson was a member of the ABA Commission who worked on this Uniform Act and was a consultant, and she also has published a couple of articles, and I'm sorry I don't have all of them here today, on the value that this has in the trial court.
Okay, follow up, Representative Anderson, and we also do have another question.
Another question. Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned Judge Anderson. I don't know that name except my last name is Anderson. But there must have been something that she's found in dealing with children in cases that there's been some evidence of a certain case being tainted, or that something as a result of a final decision-making process whereby a case was decided and after the fact the judges said, oh my word, we did it injustice or something like that. Is that true, or am I fishing for things here?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I think your comment is insightful, and I do believe that there may have been concerns in that regard, but also concerns for the long-term effect on children who are testifying in courtroom situations.
Okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Lansing, when I sat next to you in law school, I didn't realize you were going to be an appellate judge sometime. You weren't planning on it at that point either.
Representative Mullery, I'm delighted to see you here as well.
I've got a few questions. How many states have the criminal version of this now? You mentioned that only three have adopted it across the board, and I was wondering how many.
Judge Lansing?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, as in law school, I wish I had the immediate answer to that. But just based on my sort of anecdotal knowledge of it, I know that there are at least, I'd say, 10 states that have some aspect of it.
Of the criminal.
Representative Mullery, follow-up?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. What does the criminal defense bar think of the results so far in Minnesota on the I think you said it's been in the criminal side for, I didn't hear how long, but could you answer those two questions?
Judge Lansing?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, it has, I can't remember exactly when it was enacted in Minnesota. As a uniform law commissioner from Minnesota, it's often interesting that we will have adopted some aspect of a bill that then the Uniform Law Commission takes up, and then we sometimes extend it out and bring it back, and that's the circumstance that happened here. So it has been, in effect, when we were considering this as to promulgate it as a rule in the Evidence Committee, the Supreme Court Evidence Committee, we got very little negative response on how it had worked so far. We had prosecutors as well as public defenders who came before the Evidence Committee and General Rules of Practice Committee, and as far as we can tell, it's worked reasonably well in that limited area where they have deal with violent crime.
Representative Mullery?
Has any of the Bar Association sections looked at this uniform law here?
Representative Hilstrom, if you'd like to answer? Madam Chair, sorry, Representative Mullery. I do not know which sections have, but actually one section of the Bar, the family law section, came to the last committee, and they said that they hadn't had a chance to look at it. They committed to working with us. We have sent out emails to contact with them and to work with them, and so we're still working on that piece.
And Madam Chair, okay, I think
Representative Mullery, we have two more people too, so Representative Mullery.
I used to be on civil litigation section there, so I would hope that they also get asked to have a part say in it. And Judge Lansing, I was just a little worried when you said there weren't too many or something like that objections to it, that that might raise a concern with me as to what those objections were from attorneys or something.
Judge Lansing, and then this is going to your committee, Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, it would be a very unusual circumstance in the Evidence Committee that I have been a member of for the Supreme Court Committee on Evidence for public defenders or prosecutors not to raise some issue on almost everything that came up. And it is that adversarial context, as you know, that we get all this valuable information from. But I can give you my reaction that I don't think there was anything of substance that should be a cause for concern.
Okay. Representative Mason?
Madam Chair, Judge, this is an area where I don't have a lot of expertise, and I do see in the last part that both parties are supposed to have the same amounts of ability to examine the child witness. I do know that having a child witness makes things very, very difficult. So my question is this in any way going to restrict the ability of, how would I put it, the opposing side to get accurate information, or, and that's not quite the way I want to put it. Certainly I think sometimes children can be influenced by the people who are taking care of them. Is this doing anything to make that, move away from that type of influence at all? Does it change it?
Judge Lansing?
Madam Chair, Representative, your concerns are valid concerns, and that's part of what has been an impetus for this bill. And I would say that by providing a very structured procedure, the problems that arise can be dealt with in a more global approach when they come up. We're trying to encourage the courts to use their discretionary powers to make sure that the full evidence is coming out, and that, as we mentioned before in the exchange, that it is not being compromised in some way. And so that's the goal of it. And often, the more careful attention to procedures will actually have that effect. And working out a method of approaching it in advance that takes into account the particular offense, the particular litigation, or the family situation of the child, if it is, for instance, a dissolution proceeding or custody issue, does bring in some of those assurances so that you can get this considered in the way it ought to be considered. And that's one of the reasons that we're trying to provide a very predictable, regulated structure.
Okay. Representative Anderson, you have another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lansing, would you say that the shielding of a child witness would diminish the presumption of innocence?
Judge Lansing?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we don't view this as a shielding in any respect. We view it as an alternative means, but I suppose one person's shielding might be another person's alternative means. But we're trying to make sure that both, I mean, as it currently is, we have it for the defendants in the violent crimes, as I've indicated, but we're trying to make sure that both attorneys have the full opportunity to pursue the testimony. But it's just, it takes into account the sort of human factors that often courts are not very good at taking into account, and trying to figure out what will cause the child to feel sufficiently comfortable so that they will give fuller testimony and undistracted testimony.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Anderson. Ms. Lansing, thank you, Madam Chair. What about doing like a post-case type counseling for these individuals that are testing? Has that been tried?
Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, I don't know of any formal methods that have been put into place in Minnesota or elsewhere on doing that. I think it's an excellent idea. It's very interesting to hear accounts of what the feelings of children after they have testified, and also years later to have them express what it felt like to be in those circumstances. But mostly we've done it episodically, and it's been done by nonprofit groups that have been particularly interested in child welfare, but we haven't done it as a court structure or as a governmental structure that I know of.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm concerned about this, the language and the way it's going. I see it as maybe probable, and I'm not really too excited about the bill.
Okay. Representative Dzhokhovsky and the members, we do have two other bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lansing, my concern is that we're our level of sensitivity for the emotional condition of the children may potentially compromise justice. And to what level do children lie normally? Do we know what that is?
Judge Lansing?
Madam Chair and Representative, I wish that we were able to ascertain that, because then so many other things would be easy. But as you know, it's a human system. We can't determine when children are telling the truth, the degree of their capacity to communicate. We have the time-honored methodologies of asking children questions to try to determine their competency, and this doesn't change that. But we don't, you know, we can't ever be sure. All we can try to do is to develop structures and systems where they will be most like, where judges and attorneys come to an agreement where they would be most likely to express as fully as they can their account of a circumstance or their feelings on something.
Follow up, Representative Dzhokhovsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Lansing, if how would you characterize the potential for kids to tell the truth or to bring about a fabricated accounting of what happened when they are shielded behind the protections that are placed in this bill relative to when they're confronted with the stark reality of, you know, they're in front of somebody who they may be accusing or telling a story about. Do you get where I'm going there?
Representative Hillstrom?
Yeah, if I might. Representative Dzhokhovsky, this is already the current law for the criminal side of things. And so this is just kind of an expansion as well to make it more uniform, just to let you know that, but then I'll let the testifier answer.
Judge Lansing?
And Madam Chair, Representative Dzhokhovsky, once I don't have the psychological expertise to be able to answer that as fully as I wish I could, but I do want to say that in drafting this act, the Uniform Law Commission did have experts who came in and talked about the effect of certain systems on children, and they also did a very thorough survey of any available articles and studies. So I don't have them at my fingertips, but I will tell you that that is part of the process, and I know that it was particularly used in this process.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments from members? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify in favor or in opposition to House File 720? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom, would you like to renew your motion that House File 720 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion carries. Chair Hillstrom, would you like to proceed with your next bill, or would you?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 818 be recommended to pass, and the next committee is
Commerce and Labor.
Commerce and Labor.
Yep. And I understand you have an amendment.
Madam Chair, I do, and I announced earlier that none of the amendments for today met the 24-hour rule, and we already accepted one from Representative Kelly, and I'm hoping that members will permit me to use that waiver as well for the amendment in your packet.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, we can...
You don't follow
Well, we don't have all of the amendments. Madam Chair, the amendment is being passed out, and with me is the folks that brought me this bill. I want members to know that this is not a bill I dreamt up. In fact, 52 agencies, entities, and organizations were involved in developing this proposal. 50 to 60 individuals participated at each of the 8 stakeholder meetings. 10 subcommittees divided up the work on specific issues, on reporting definitions and protections to bring the recommendations to the stakeholder group, and 323 individuals from across Minnesota participated in a 39-question online survey to gain broad input on issues regarding this Vulnerable Adults Act. So, Madam Chair and members, I would like to turn it over to those who have been working on this issue and let them talk about it.
All right. If each of the testifiers could say their name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, my name is Ann Bebo, and I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department.
Madam Chair, I'm Phil Carruthers, and I'm the Director of the Prosecution Division for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office.
Great. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I've done is this section has lots of different sections, or this bill has lots of different sections that belong in lots of different committees. And so in Representative Less's committee, I asked the group to stick to the crime victims' portions and things that would be applicable, and I've asked the witnesses here as well if they would talk to the things that would be applicable to this committee, realizing, members, that this has lots of areas to go to. It'll go to commerce, it may go to health, it's going to go to finance, it has lots and lots of stuff.
And Representative Hilton, it's a very bipartisan bill.
It's that expression.
Proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to let people know what my background is before I begin testifying. But I've been a member of the Vulnerable Adults Project Act group for a while. I'm also the vice chair of the Mayor's Advisory Committee on Aging, and also part of a multidisciplinary training group on elder abuse. I've been working with the St. Paul Police Department for 22 years. My background is I graduated from St. Mary's College, and I've had 2 years in accounting. This problem has been a passion of mine since about 2001, when I began investigating elder abuse cases. I worked on a study in January of last year, and I've learned that there's many, many changes that need to be made within our own department on how we handle elder abuse cases that come in. And I know that law can be very dry, but I would like to bring to light an individual that I worked with that kind of points out why we need some changes in the way we're dealing with elder abuse and this law in specific. I worked with a man named Alvin Belsey, and he is a resident of St. Paul and worked for 33 years with the Hines Company. His parents died when he was young. He never married. He had no children. He had no heirs for his estate. He had about $200,000 saved up. A neighbor next door befriended him when he became frail. He's 92 years old, and he was a World War II vet. He was at the point where he needed people to come in and help him. A neighbor came in to help him, and she eventually moved him next door into her house. This man essentially became a prisoner of war in his own home. This is a man who fought and served for his country and put his life at risk and became a prisoner of war in his own home. This woman built him out of almost $200,000. The money was all spent at casinos. She put his home on the market, which he was not able to even know that because he was not ambulatory. He could not get it along. He would be left to sit in a chair all day with no phone accessible, no walker there, so he could not get around the house. In addition, when I showed up with Adult Protection to help this person, I had learned that she had put his home in the newspaper, and there was a rummage sale going on, and she had put stickers on all of his items and was having people come in. The article in the admin newspaper said, "No reasonable offer denied, everything must go." She was selling off everything. All the money went to the casinos. In the end, we were able to prove a financial exploitation, but the very, very sad thing about it was that he had wanted to give all his money to the Como Zoo, and I know that they are needing a polar bear display right now. There's a problem out there. Probably some other issues, but the zoo was very important to him. All the money is gone, and because of the way the laws are today, Nothing happened with this woman except she got probation and was ordered to pay back the funds, of which she had no means of being employed at that point, and I don't know how long it would take for someone to pay back a person's entire life savings. A long time. The man's 92 years old and the money's gone. This bill that we proposed will allow us to respond faster to crimes to stop the flow of money. This is a person's life savings that's totally gone. It also provides immunity for businesses and financial institutions that are acting on good faith. Oftentimes, banks and businesses are reluctant to provide us with financial information because they're afraid of what's going to happen to them. It establishes educational requirements, which I think is very, very important because elder abuse cases are very complicated. And not anybody can go in and investigate them. You need to have some kind of background to be able to understand finances. You need to be able to understand the complex dynamics of elder abuse. They're very similar to domestic violence. Stiffer penalties. I don't think that someone who bilks somebody out of $200,000 should be able to get probation. There's something definitely wrong there. And it increases the statute of limitations. Oftentimes in my work, I have seen that this does not come to light for a long time. What suspects do to our victims is they isolate them from family members who want to help. They isolate them from friends. Oftentimes they're disabled. They're not ambulatory. They can't get out. They're deprived of being able to use a telephone. Because of that, by the time we get the reports, a long time has elapsed. The suspect has had a long time of being able to bilk a person out of their life savings. And we all know what our economic times are looking like right now. Who takes care of the elderly or disabled person when their life savings is gone? It comes upon the taxpayers to do that. Oftentimes our victims are deceased by the time we get them. This should not put a bar in our being able to prosecute people. And that hasn't. We still are able to prosecute people even after the victim has died. But there needs to be education. The people that are involved in prosecuting or investigating these cases need to understand that you can still move forward even if the victim has passed away. So I've been passionate about this issue for many years. I am just thrilled that I'm here sitting here today and we've come this far. And I can tell you just from the other states I know about, our state is farther behind than other states on where we should be in being able to protect our elderly and vulnerable adult population. And if anybody's been kind of keeping up on the demographic changes, the baby boomer population is aging very rapidly, and by 2030, we're going to have a substantial number of people over age 65, and I believe it's 1 in 20. So this is not going to go away. And with 1 in 5 cases being not reported right now, it's going to be a tidal wave. And I think we need to get ready and think about what our laws are going to be and make the right changes to be able to protect people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Debo. Representative Hillstrom, do you have anything to add, or Mr. Carruthers?
Madam Chair, Phil Carruthers, and as I mentioned, I'm with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. We do have a Elder Abuse Prosecution Unit, and so we've been very interested in seeing this legislation pass. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association also supports it. These are challenging cases to prosecute. The crimes of isolation and control. A lot of the problems is powers of attorney or joint accounts. They're hard to get financial records. It's hard to investigate and prosecute these complex cases. So let me just briefly tell you about the provisions. Section 1, 2, 5, and 11, what all of those do is make it easier to get financial records about vulnerable adults. One of the provisions, for example, provides the administrative subpoena power of prosecutors to obtain the records of vulnerable adults. It also encourages banks to cooperate in those efforts to get these records. Section 6 amends the financial exploitation statute. This has been proposed by the Attorney General's office and is supported by our group. And it does a number of things. It amends the financial exploitation statute so that it also would cover using, managing, or taking the real or personal property or other financial resources of a vulnerable adult for the benefit of someone other than the vulnerable adult. And then also, it would be a crime to establish a relationship with a fiduciary obligation to a vulnerable adult by use of undue influence or harassment, force, or duress. And the case that Sergeant Debo was talking about is one that our office has been involved with, and that was one where, as I recall, there was no family relationship, but the person took advantage of the dementia of the elderly person and essentially, through duress, forced the person to sign over all of their assets. The other thing is it takes away a defense of of consent, where the person lacks the capacity to consent, which is very important, so that that would not be a defense. Let me mention that in Section 7, the bill would increase financial exploitation crime penalties where the amount stolen was $35,000 or greater, and would make that 20-year felony. Section 8 sets up a right of a speedy trial, because these are elderly people in many cases, and sometimes they do, unfortunately, face health problems. Then Section 19 would extend the statute of limitations for those large financial exploitation cases where there's $35,000 or more, from 3 years, what it is currently, to 5 years. And so, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is the bill, and the prosecutors, both in the County Attorneys Association and that were part of this group, strongly support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carruthers. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sergeant Debo, I heard in your testimony comments about how this woman bilked the guy out of $200,000 and got away with probation. You may have heard or read in the papers that much fanfare is being made around here these days about characterizing people like her as nonviolent offenders who really shouldn't be taking up space in our prison system or in our jails, and we ought to be just making room for just the violent offenders. What is a response to that?
Ms. Debo?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I would like to say that on the surface we can look at these kinds of crimes as paper crimes, but if you take a look what this gentleman suffered, it was a kind of emotional abuse that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. When this man went to the nursing home, I went to visit him because I just really felt a connection with him, and he was alone. He had no one. So I went to visit him there, and they were having a problem with him going to physical therapy, wouldn't go. And I asked him, I said, Elvin, why won't you go to physical therapy? You might get strong enough where you can start walking. And he said he didn't want to go. And after talking to him for a while, I found out what she had done to him was she was threatening him with going to the nursing home. And he was worried about going there. And that's, a lot of people are worried about going to the nursing home. That's not what we have in our future. We want to be strong and healthy and end our days that way. She made him march in the corner in place, and she would have him hold his walker and stand there and march in place for over an hour at a time. When people came to the house, she'd have his Depends undergarments sitting right out in the open and refer to them very loudly as Elvin's diapers. During a search warrant, I found a journal that she had written everything that she had done with him up there. One of the things she had done that just made me sick after I read it, I just had to go take a break. She's journaling in there how this man was in bed, and he needed to go to the restroom. And she asked him, please, can you help me go to the restroom? Elvin weighed about 90 pounds. I could have picked him up myself. Just a small, frail man. Sorry.
Take your time.
She journals in there about how he wanted to go to the bathroom. And she said, Elvin, you need to use your own muscle strength and get yourself out of bed. If you can't get yourself out of bed, you're going to a nursing home. And she journaled how this frail man continued to pull himself up, or tried to pull himself up, and kept falling and kept pulling himself up and falling. Eventually, he had a bowel movement on himself. At this point, she yelled at him and called her husband over to clean him up. And this is what this man endured. And I read about that, and it took me about a minute to get through reading it. And it had that kind of effect on me, and I was not the victim of the case. This man lived this way every single day of the time he was with this woman.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, follow-up?
Follow-up. Thank you for that testimony.
You're welcome.
Sergeant. My second question is this. In the proposed changes, what changes as proposed in this law would have helped you intervene quicker, or why would the situation be different if this legislation were passed for the situation that you described?
Sergeant Peebles.
Representative Lesh, Madam Chair. One of the things that I think would have really changed it is that there is some standardized protocol as to what steps need to be handled in an investigation. And without going into details and naming any names, one of the things that happened is the adult protection worker was prevented from doing her job. She was actually told not to investigate this case. And some basic steps that should have been taken place, that could have been mandated by law, could have been in place to help this man.
Follow-up, Representative? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and members, I'd just like to speak in favor of the bill. We had a case like this this last year, a vulnerable adult, where the son took advantage of the mother and the rest of the family was turning him in, and it took me a year of letters to the Attorney General and to the Sheriff where this person lived, and I looked down through the different sections of the bill that would have directly addressed several of the blockades and obstacles that we ran into. It would have really helped the case that I worked on for that long and got it done a lot quicker and more efficiently.
Either to Mr. Carruthers or Sergeant Peebles or Representative Hilton, Section 9 talks about the reporting. I don't know, and 10 talks about the actual immunity of the reporters. Maybe if you want to talk a little bit about that, unless Representative Hilton, that will be in a different committee. I guess that's just my question that I have.
It technically is in another committee, and so I didn't really bring the folks to get that, but didn't do it. Madam Chair, members, Iris Freeman. I'm with the William Mitchell College of Law Elder Justice Center, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the bill.
Welcome to the
9. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Section 9 is a resolution to a problem that has been experienced by nursing homes, boarding care homes, and swing beds in hospitals. Currently, the federal government has one set of timelines and rules for how maltreatment is reported. The state has another set of timelines and rules. This change in law is the product of our group having worked with the Department of Health and the various stakeholders to assure that there will be one report, it will be faster, there is no fiscal note attached to it.
Thank you, I appreciate that. I don't sit on the Civil Law Committee, so I should have probably asked that up at a later date. Sheldon, Representative Johnson, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cruthers, what is the current options for penalties for this kind of incident that's been described where a vulnerable adult has been taken for more than $35,000? I just need to have a sense of to what extent that we're increasing the penalty.
Okay, well, let me just double check. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think it's I believe it's a 5-year felony, I think. It's either a 3 or a 5-year felony, so this substantially increases those thefts that are greater than $35,000. And council may know for sure. I was just looking at the language, but it does. This is special language as to those large thefts. That doesn't tell me what the existing one is. So let me just quickly see if I can find it. Okay. I'm sorry. It's just a year and a day. It's a year and a day. So it's barely a felony. You know, if it was just a year, it'd be a gross misdemeanor.
Sure. Mr. Cruthers, we could have Ms. Pierce.
Madam Chair, if you look at page 5, line 33, would that answer your question? If the value of property exceeds $5,000, it would be a 10-year felony?
Mr. Cruthers, I have the statute book in front of me, and it looks like Representative Johnson is coordinating with the current theft protocol. So, for example, if something is over 30, if the loss is over $35,000, it is a 20-year felony according to our current guidelines or thresholds right now. But, Mr. Cruthers, if you have...
Madam Chair, yeah, I'm looking at page 5.
subdivision 3, line 5.20 down to 5.23. That gives the current penalties. And as I read that, it's just a year and a day felony. So, you know, right now, you steal, if you're being prosecuted on financial exploitation and you steal $200,000, it's a year and a day. So, which means that's a probationary sentence. There's, you know, there's no way that's going to be a serve time in prison sentence. You'll probably get some time in the workhouse, but there's no way you're going to get any prison. So it goes to the point that Representative Lesch and Sergeant Bebo made about why we need some heavier duty penalties.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I know there's degrees of exploitation, and the 20 years would be like as high as you could go then, just so I understand. I mean, if it was a case where the exploitation was less than what the sergeant had offered that case, which is a terrible case to present it, but let's say it was someone who had a gambling habit and stole $40,000 from somebody who didn't abuse the adult, so wouldn't necessarily get 20 years then. The judge would have the discretion to make whatever judgment based on that case.
Mr. Crothers?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. And, of course, Representative Johnson, you, working in probation, you deal with this stuff all the time. And so when the legislature says something's a 20-year felony, you know, it's up to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to rank the offense and determine where it will actually end up. And, of course, then it's a factor of your criminal history and then the ranking of the offense. So, you know, I don't want to give the impression that just because the statute says that it's up to 20 years that you're going to get 20 years. I mean, in fact, you're not going to get 20 years. But, you know, I would say that the chance of getting something like maybe a 48-month sentence would substantially increase. But it will be up to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and it also depends on what your criminal history score is.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And Ms. Jackson, Representative Jackson. I'm sorry. I don't know if I should be calling you former Speaker Crothers, and I'm calling people by first names. I'm sorry.
This is actually for Representative Hillstrom, and it's only a little off the mark, but one of the things that I'm immediately going to as I think about these scenarios is, and this would be for civil, but anybody doing anything that would make voidable, at least voidable, any, like, last will and testaments? Because, you know, some of these folks get quite a handle on the elderly I've seen. And I'd like to know if anybody's doing anything for the voidability of powers of attorney, you know, trusts, wills, anything else like that.
President Hilton, is there any other witnesses, or should that wait to civil law?
I don't.
Madam Chair, I don't think there's anything in this, but
okay.
I certainly will pass that idea on to this group of folks. That this is a consensus bill,
okay.
And so I want to make sure that whatever ends up in here at the end of the day is a consensus, right. And if they think it's great and everybody comes to consensus, we'll be talking.
All right, any other questions? Okay, we do have to move the amendment, and then we do have a person that would like to testify. Representative Hillstrom. If you want to move your amendment, the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have the A1 amendment. And I'd like to have former Representative Crothers talk about it.
Sorry, I started the train. Mr. Crothers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something that was suggested by the Minnesota Bankers Association and their members. And because so many of the provisions that I highlighted deal with getting access to the financial records of vulnerable adults, we wanted to make sure that we were working with these financial institutions so that the law would be easily used by them and it would not become complicated or administratively difficult. And so what they said was, they said they'd like to have the language spelled out in greater detail about what kind of financial records would be accessible through an administrative subpoena, for example. And so they asked that we lay out examples of the types of records that we want, not necessarily an exclusive list, but examples. And thus, in line 1.2 through 1.6, it lays out in more detail the kinds of records that that we could obtain through an administrative subpoena. And then they also made a good suggestion, which is they made the point that, you know, sometimes these financial records are in joint names, or they're in the power of attorney has basically put all of the accounts in the name of the attorney in fact, the person who's using the power of attorney. So it shouldn't just be the stated name of the vulnerable adult. It should be their property that could be held in somebody else's name. So they made that excellent suggestion. And then they asked for a provision, and that's found in 1.1 through 3 through 1.15 for some immunity from liability, because you know, they get whipsawed back and forth. They might have somebody maybe a attorney in fact who is very defensive and doesn't want to provide the records. Maybe they threaten them with a lawsuit, and so they want to be able to, in good faith, say, look, we're not only allowed to provide this, but we're immune from the risk of lawsuits if we provide this. So I think that's a good provision too. So and the Bankers Association people are here, and they can speak for themselves if you have further questions.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would move the adoption of the A1 amendment.
Okay, any questions from members on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Are there any questions to the bill from members as amended? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Neumeister would like to testify.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to see you for the first time this year.
Yep, please state your name for the record.
It's Rich Neumeister. For those people that may not know myself, who are new to the legislative process, I've already indicated my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm a citizen who for decades has lobbied on issues of privacy, civil liberties, and openness and freedom of information in government. And I don't get no money for what I do. It's a good bill that's being proposed before you, but I think there are sometimes in details that it devils in the details, and I want to point some of those things out to you. If you look on page 1, line 21, when you look on, let me go down first where it says lead agencies on page 23, as defined in 626-5572, that includes two agencies. That includes the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. So you're giving the authority for these two departments to get access to...
I'm sorry, Mr. Newman, I said there's no page...
Page 1?
Page 1, line 20.
Okay, I'm sorry, you said page 23. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Page 1, line 24. So
okay.
Those are two agencies other than law enforcement and the county attorney's office. Now, my overall concern here is, since we have financial privacy, and that's a very important thing, and with a lot of agencies doing investigations, some may be criminal, some may just become under the aspect of 626-556, I believe, which is the vulnerable adult. So I'm concerned about overall how financial record privacy is protected. This is making another exception of a lower standard than what is now currently under Chapter 13A for administrative subpoena. Now, Mr. Crothers mentioned about at least they're amending in Section 5 in this bill about administrative subpoena. But then when I look on page 1, lines 23 through 26, on line 24, I see words certified in writing, which is different, from my point of view, of what an administrative subpoena is. So, and then also there's reference to 609-535, which you look on page 1, line 21, 609.535 is the worthless check thing that was done a few years ago. Again, does a certification of writing, and there is some real specific language of how law enforcement gets that information, and also works a lot with Chapter 13A so that when people get notice. So overall, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to bring it to your attention that I think there are some details here about to be able to protect people's privacy, also to have accountability of when we allow social service agencies and law enforcement to be able to get access to this kind of private information. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I spoke with the chairperson, and I know this is a continuing thing in progress. I dealt with Madam Chair, for two years on Social Security, so I'm someone who has worked with her on that. But as a courtesy, I wanted to bring that issue to your attention.
Thank you,
because I'm sure you may have had some interest on some of that.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chapter 13 is in Representative Mallory's committee, so I'm certain that Representative Mallory will air that issue loudly.
Okay. Anyone else would like to testify in favor and opposition to this bill? Please approach the testifying table and state your name for the record. And we do have one more bill to get through.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Dave Jansen once again. And I agree with the previous testifier on the act that we need to have immunity for banks, for everybody who gives out this private information.
Okay. This is going to be going to civil law.
Okay.
And so for, I think there was a little bit of lenience for Mr. Neumeister too, because I didn't exactly know what he was going to be testifying about when it talked about immunity and the records and stuff. But this is going to be going to Representative Mallory's committee. Yeah, if you...
Okay. Yeah, about the criminal, I think the person who does this crime against a vulnerable adult should be held criminally liable more than they currently are. They need to be held financially accountable, more so than putting them in jail. They need to get the money back to the family of, excuse me, of this potentially deceased individual, since we're dealing with the elderly.
Thank you.
So that's, and I apologize for going on the immunity. I do.
No, that's no problem. Thank you for your testimony.
And thank you for allowing me to testify before.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or opposition to House File 818? Okay, seeing none. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hilstrom renews her motion that House File 818 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Commerce and Labor Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Members, I ask that you stay just a while longer so Representative Tamar has the opportunity to present his bill. We got a late start because session went. We'll try to wrap up as soon as we can. Representative Tamar, would you like to move your bill?
Very controversial. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 248 and recommend that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety policy bill.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair. To your
Chair, I was going to move it to the consent calendar, but if we're going to put it on the Hilstrom's bill, that's great.
Madam Chair, this bill was heard in Representative in the Crime Victim Criminal Records Division. And basically what it does is a very simple bill. It simply removes the 30-month pilot project status and the references to the 4th Judicial District for fatality review team. For those of you who don't know what a fatality review team is, it's a team of professionals in the criminal and civil justice systems and law enforcement that review domestic violence, homicide, with an eye toward finding systemic problems that can be corrected. So the Fatality Review Board committee reviews several cases a year, and then makes recommendations to those interveners, and oftentimes what comes out of that is increased education, sometimes some policy changes. So that's the genesis of fatality review teams. Many states have them. We don't have them statewide. This is only done currently in the 4th Judicial District. This would allow other judicial districts, if they wanted to establish a fatality review team. And what else does it do? It also eliminates the need for two annual reports to the legislature and requires only one. That's the bill, members.
Representative Mullery has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamer, I see Representative Smith has a bill in that would apply to, somehow I can't remember exactly what it does, but something like you can get protective orders in domestic abuse cases for pets or something. Would this apply to that?
Chair Hamer?
Madam Chair, this says nothing, would have nothing to do with that. This is a review process for victims of domestic violence who've been killed.
Okay, Madam Chair, so it's only if they're killed.
Yes, fatality review.
Okay. Any other questions for members? Not. Well, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on House File 248? Please approach the testify stand and welcome to the committee. If you could state your names for the record.
I want to, for the record, indicate what I do for my day job, although I'm not representing my office here.
Can you please state your name?
I will. My name is James E. Branchford. I work as a legal dispositional advisor in the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office, that's the 4th Judicial District. I have some secondary experience with the Fatality Review Board, and my concern is that the one that existed, and it perhaps still does exist, in Hennepin, does not represent the people who, in fact, are quite often victims of the domestic violence, but more particularly are fatal victims of domestic violence. The last one, it may still be in existence, had no people of color. When I complained, I believe I complained initially to now Senator Klobuchar, who was the chief prosecutor at the time, later to Judge Shearer, who was the presiding judge, and they had one Somali guy who was a friend of mine, had no experience with domestic violence. No Native Americans, no Somali people who were victims or service providers, no African Americans, no foreigners. My concern, and I've been working in the area of family violence in general, and more particularly family violence in communities of color for about 25 years, I did not see any representation of the people who either perpetrators or victims, and my concern was that if this becomes a statewide, or if it continues in Hennepin County or in Ramsey, where the larger populations are, that there at least be people on the planning and the review committee from the communities in question.
Okay.
Again, I'm not representing the Department of the Public Defender's Office here, although I did talk with one of our team leaders and let him know that I was coming, so I didn't want to be a complete outlaw or outlier.
Sounds good. Representative Paymar, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with that. I only know the criminal and civil court and public defenders. I know the players that are involved, the agencies that are involved. I don't know the players that are involved. If what Mr. Branchford
yes.
is saying is true, I would be happy to write a letter to the advisory board as well as to the advisory board and bring those issues up. The advisory board should certainly reflect the device culture of Hennepin County. This is the first system where I've been apprised of this, so I'd be happy to take some steps to change that.
Madam Chair and Representative Tamar, that would certainly be my concern. I'm not so interested in specific legislation mandating that there has to be balkanization of the situation, but that there should be a representation. And I suspect that, as many of you know, Representative Tamar has a high reputation in the domestic violence field anyway. I'm sure a letter from him would be sufficient.
Okay. Well, thank
you.
Thank you for your testimony, and the chair does lay over House File 248. Meeting is adjourned.